With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
The Province Sports Podcast.
Welcome to our Whitetail Hockey Podcast, brought to you by the good folks at Key West Ford. You can visit them at keywestford.com. Largest selection of trucks in BC. They're also BC's number one Mustang dealer. Joined with the A-team this week, sorry, Ben, we've got Ed Willis, Patrick Johnson, and a top-line producer, Darma Kwana, with us. Hello, gentlemen.
Hi.
Hey, you know, I think before we get started, we need to find out where Patrick falls out on the whole T-Rex going into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame question, which really, really burned up Twitter there for a couple of days afterwards.
Yeah, the numbers, Ed and I did talk Rock and Roll Hall of Fame last week, kind of tried to tie it towards Canucks and Hall of Fame discussion, but we'll leave that for the end. We are going to talk All-Star Games a little bit, talk about the Canucks, obviously, their representation at the All-Star Game. We'll talk a little bit about where the Canucks will go once they get back from this extended break, and we'll also talk about our Canucks and 50 series as we go through the 90s here. Some interesting stuff coming up. So let's start with the All-Star Game. I know in our we do these videos. If you haven't happened to see them, Ed and I talked All-Star Game in one we recorded today. Patrick, I'll ask you, what does it mean for the three Canucks that are going to the All-Star Game to be there?
I think it's a very cool recognition for all of them. Pettersson obviously is a known quantity around the league, but you know, Quinn Hughes, it's strange to say, but I feel like he's still flying a bit under the radar, partly just because, you know, I don't know if people know what to make of him. And of course, we're seeing this ongoing debate right now about him versus Cale Makar. And, you know, the fact that I think the point that people are missing is like Quinn Hughes has been playing against the other team's top pairing for quite a long time now, which is such a statement about a young defenseman. And the skating. I mean, we always talk about the skating, and I think, you know, this is such a venue for him to be able to show that off. I have a feeling that this is going to be a bit of a coming out party for him. And then, of course, Jacob Markstrom, such an incredible story, you know, such a late bloomer in terms of his actual performance. And, you know, obviously the story this year with his father passing away and him still performing through all that, you know, and getting a bit of, you know, like I said, a sort of older recognition of performance. I think it's a great story for all three of them. And, you know, obviously it's a great story for who these Vancouver Canucks want to be, because these are, each guy is a key element in their story going forward.
Ed, in the cynical world that, you know, the media used to be called cynical, but man, you add social media to it, and the amount of hot takes that have to go on about tearing everything down, you lose sight maybe of the fact that for Quinn Hughes, a kid who grew up around hockey, you've referenced many times his family, what it will mean to rub elbows with the players he's going to rub elbows with this weekend.
Yeah, I talked to him a bit about him before the break, and the kid's maturity, his grasp of hockey culture and the things that need to be said and the things that needed to be done to gain acceptance in a veteran room continues to impress me. And you know, I asked him, you know, like, are you going to have some of those aha moments when you look and realize that, you know, 6-7 years ago I was collecting that guy's hockey card, now here I am. And he goes, yeah, but he says to belong you have to look like you belong. And wow. This is a kid who just turned 20, and he gets it. And, you know, just further to Patrick's point, it's great for the organization. It does. It's a validation. It says so many things about the direction they're going. But I'm just struck about the difference in all three stories and what they represent, because all yes. three are completely different. All three should be taking something a little different out of this experience, out of this game. And I think in all three cases, it's nothing but positive for the player and the organization.
Yeah, and I'd like you to give your thoughts on Markstrom a little bit. We did talk about it when we did video, but this is a guy, the experience you talk about, Quinn Hughes, at that end of it, you know, Markstrom's been around the NHL for such a long time now, and now he gets to be included amongst the elite.
Yeah, this is really his third year as a number one goalie, right? He turned 30, and you look at the journey he was on to, you know, sort of elite prospect to suspect to minor leaguer, third stringer, backup. And now he's kind of, now he's established himself as a bona fide number one. Yeah, I wrote about this last Sunday, but there is underlying data which strongly suggests he is a top five goalie in the NHL. And I think going forward, that is the one advantage the Canucks have in their division. I think they've got the best goalie of all those teams clustered around that playoff spot. And I think that will out at the end. But for Markstrom, I mean, again, it's just such a great story. And it's kind of old school, you know, and they used to think mostly it applies to Johnny Bauer, that goalies really don't mature until their late 20s, early 30s. But every now and then.
His stride in his late 30s.
That's right. That's right. But, you know, along comes this guy and he does the same thing.
I did laugh, Ed, when you acknowledged the fact that you'd put analytics in your...
Yeah, well, I had to be led by the hand and pointed to the site by our good friend Kevin Woodley.
It is such a true statement, though. Yeah. I mean, the fact is he is facing hard shots, but he's doing really well in them, and a lot of that is a testament to the work that he's put in with Ian Clark as well. Because, you know, he was a player, I think, a goalie who had a hard time both setting himself mentally but also physically, and now he's so much of a calmer. You know, that's the thing Kevin always tells me: watch how calm they are, see what they're doing, and certain little things to look for. And he's just been so solid at that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think you're right. I do think in terms of that weird team grouping that they're now in the Pacific, that, you know, obviously Marc-Andre Fleury always had the headlines, but he's getting on in age and I don't think he's the best goalie.
Yeah, he's having a substandard
year.
And
the only other competitor might be Darcy Kemper, but Darcy Kemper who? Like, you know, part of that story is that the Coyotes have been so good defensively.
Calgary's been getting some amazing goaltending.
Yeah,
Riddich,
I would say Riddich before Darcy Kemper,
But at the end of the day, Calgary also can't seem to put it together, so we don't talk about him as much, I suppose.
I want to talk to both of you about, obviously, we've talked about Hughes and Markstrom a lot this year, but for a guy like Pettersson, going back to the Ulster game, did he seem enamored when he came back last year?
I think he loved it last year. Yeah, I think he just was kind of really enjoyed the whole experience very much. That, you know, yeah, that hockey card, oh my goodness, who I'm with all these guys, this is amazing. I think he really enjoyed it. And I think he's excited to do it again this year. I think he is a guy that, you know, wants to be known, right? He wants to be the guy that's the best. And this is a statement in his, for sure in his mind, that this is yes, you know, like, I'm doing well. This is a way for him to sort of grade himself, say, yes, I'm still there, I'm doing better, I'm going to be leading the charge. I'm now someone that, you know, needs to be there, and if I'm not there, I'm questioning myself.
I think there was a little bit of that I'm starstruck thing, but I think there was a larger part of, you know, I belong here with him. I mean, the kid is nothing if not confident in his ability, in a kind of an understated way, as you'd expect with most Swedes. But you know, I talked to him about that, and he kind of gave the pro forma answer, and then he stopped and he said, I got a piece coming later in the week. He said, you know, I wasn't there to be a fanboy.
Yeah.
And I think that very much, and I think it's one of the reasons why, you know, I think it like the Sedins and how deferential they were when they came in. Same with Marcus. You know, I had a lengthy interview with Marcus Naslund yesterday, so he's front of mind. This kid comes with a little different mindset, a little different, you know, confidence in himself, a little bit more surety of his place and his talents and where he can go with this thing. And I think it's a real interesting comparison, just considering the level of Swedish players we've seen in Vancouver, because this cat's a different animal.
Well, and it also speaks, for instance, to like why you almost don't want to ask him about the Michigan, the goal, you know, Svechnikov pulling it off, or whoever's been pulling it off. You almost don't want to ask him at this point, because he's mad he hasn't pulled one off. He was going to try. And I mean, I remember when it first became a thing, when Hoglander pulled it off and Svechnikov, whenever that was, that in I think that was all way back in November. And I actually, like, you know, Thomas Drance tried to ask him about it, and he basically went, no comment. Like, he didn't want to talk about it. And I picked up on this.
Maybe he just didn't want to talk to Thomas.
It's also possible. I mean, this happened while this, you know, they were having this discussion.
Do you remember the game where he tried it? Yeah. He tried loading it up, and I asked him about it afterwards. I just kind of ran into him when he was done with TV, and he said, yeah, I was going for it. I can't remember the game, but I do remember it was October, like really quick, and it was kind of lost and loaded.
Can we come up with a name for it, though? Like, it's lacrosse. It's the Michigan. Michigan makes no sense.
You're going to have to, you lead the charge.
It's the Dayton Shuffle. It's the St. Louis Whirligig.
It's the T-Rex. That's what we're going to call it.
But what I was going to say was I happened to be talking to Brock Besser while this exchange is going on. And so I was able to throw it at Brock. I said, Brock, you know, he doesn't want to talk about it. And Brock goes, oh, yeah. He tried it. I bet he's pissed. He's pissed he doesn't pull it off. And he still hasn't. And you know that is the kind of thing that in the end he wants to do that because that's what the best players do. And if he hasn't pulled it off yet, well, that's a standard he hasn't met. And that's like making the All-Star game. He has to be there.
You know, if we look at what awaits them this weekend, it's, you know, those debates about All-Star game. And I have to admit, this is Pro Bowl weekend too, right? So I can't get enough of 340-pound men bench pressing. Like, I love the NFL Combine for that reason. But the whole skills part of the NFL experience is so much better for me than the actual game. And I think the same for the NHL. And we can be jaded about it because when they were still doing a traditional game and there was no defense and it was like 14-11, people just didn't care about it anymore. But the NHL's landed in a pretty good spot, haven't they? To me, the Friday, and especially with the women's 3-on-3, that's way more interesting to me than what's actually going to happen in the game.
Well, they've made it back into a spectacle, which is what it should be, because it's not a game. It's never going to be a game. It should be celebrating the fun aspects of hockey. You know, it is always been such a hard thing for them to do that because the players are wearing helmets. It's so hard to see the player personality. Here's a chance for the personalities to shine. You know, going back to the idea of having a player draft, that was, you know, a need in innovation, and the fact they haven't stood still. They said, we're going to do this for a little while. Okay, that's not working anymore. We're going to do that. And I think that definitely has been one of the better things the NHL has done, I would say, in the last decade in terms of figuring out what they want to be.
Yeah, I'm encouraged that people have stopped using All-Star games as reference points, historical reference points. I remember the great game in 2014 when it's all just a blur, right? It's all Mardi Gras. But there was a time, right? I remember, like, when as a kid growing up, it was a big deal. And the first format I remember was the All-Star team playing the Stanley Cup champions before the season started. And then it morphed into something else and something else again and something else beyond that, but it was more or less a similar kind of format for so long, and then it wasn't. But I am glad, and I think that's part of this deconstruction of that this has got to be a game. This has to mirror the best elements of hockey: the speed and the violence and the competitiveness. No, it's just a party. It's a party, and it's a showcase, and treated as such.
It is. I would say a couple things have changed today, and I agree with you. And there was a push for a long time to bring back that format and have the Stanley Cup champs play an All-Star team, but. You know, ultimately, I think before you had free agency, the chance to say, I could see Guy Lafleur play with Brian Trottier and Mike Bossy, like that was something you could never imagine happening. Now, you know, with free agency, players change teams so much. But also, let's face it, the economics have changed. I love the story about John Garrett. Richard Brodeur is injured, so John Garrett takes his place in the All-Star game and is really having a fantastic game and is in line to win a truck or a car or whatever it was. Well, that meant a lot to those players. Now, give them a car, like, really, I don't want to say who cares, but it doesn't really matter. But then, of course, he tells the story of Gretzky having this amazing third period and stealing the vehicle from those stories are great.
I think it's 94 or 95. It's in New York, and they have this skill competition, and they don't have it anymore, but it's basically a line rush. And it's to show, you know, how fast the players move the puck, and it ends up with somebody taking a shot on the goalie.
The poor goalie.
Well, it's like Al MacInnis is in this line rush, and I'm sitting up in the press box, and Neil Smith, the New York Rangers GM, is about four seats down, and they do this line rush, and they leave the puck in the dock. Al MacInnis comes in full windup and sends a tracer over top of the net right past Mike Richter's ear. I hear this. They say, can I do the bang on the desk just for sound effects? Then Neil Smith goes, what the F-bomb was that? Gets up and runs downstairs. That was one of my enduring moments from All-Star games.
Hockey hasn't really suffered one of those moments, but you think of Robert Edwards, promising rookie for the New England Patriots, taking part in a beach football tournament.
Ray Fosse in the baseball All-Star game gets run over by Pete Rose. Yeah, no,
so,
I know.
I mean, I understand the tricky part of the weekend, but it's still, I think, one of my favorite All-Star stories is just knowing that when they last had it here in 98, prior to the 98 Olympics, first time the NHLers were in the Olympics, they had North America versus the world, and they had the shootout, and Dominic Hasek shut everyone down. And who knew that the coach of Canada might have taken notice of who to play in the shootout and who not to, as they didn't win that weekend. But this is a weekend for the players, this weekend for the people. I did talk with Ed about this before. Ed, I'd like your thoughts on the women, because I think that's the one, probably the most competitive part of the weekend, is finally giving the women this stage.
I do think it's a great thing that they've done this. And again, it's part of that spectacle. It's like, this is what hockey is. This is what we want to highlight. These are things we want to highlight. And you hope that it leads to more, because women's hockey deserves to be on that stage. And there's some really talented players there in their own right. And they're hockey players. And that's how it should be. I mean, I think back to what I talked to Cammy Granato about last summer when she got hired by Seattle to be a pro scout. And she talked about how, in the end, she just didn't think we should be talking about women's hockey anymore. We should just be talking about hockey players. And this is a case of that. They're saying that you women are here and you're here on merit. And we want to talk about this more. I think it's great.
But in fairness, that sport has to grow beyond Canada and the U.S.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, we know the Olympics is the big thing, the World Championship, the fact that it's so non-competitive beyond those two teams. And in order to grow it, you have to do things like this to get people interested.
Yes, that's true. And that's kind of my point. Is, I mean, here you are. The NHL is the North American league. And sure, the NHL draws players from all over the world. But a North American women's league, there's lots of players available to make that league work. It doesn't have to be a 31-team extravaganza. No. But
look at the WNBA. Not that that's profitable yet, but it's certainly made progress.
It's got a following, and there's interest there. And the only way, like you said, the only way you can actually build interest is by actually putting it in front of people, and this is a great way to do that.
So let's get out of the the Canucks are really fortunate during this All-Star break to be given this time off, their bye or whatever you want to call it, to have such an extended break, and sandwich with home games as well. But what do we expect from this team when they come back?
It's a big push. I mean, it's 33 games. This is the amazing thing about how tight everything is. So if they had lost their last game, they would have found themselves sitting, I think, fifth in the division, 19th overall. It's really, really tight. They're in this mix. It's great for them. In relative terms, they're obviously not an elite team, but they're a good team in a mix of teams that are similarly challenged and able. And I think, it's going to be a tough push. I mean, that trip, when they come back, they have the one game at home against St. Louis, which is going to be a tough game. And then they go out on this trip, which is a bit of a funky all over the place, because they go to San Jose and then they have the long cross country flight. At least they have 2 days off, they have 2 days where they don't play between games, but then they've got two matinees again on Super Bowl weekend. And then they're in Boston, which, we know the Bruins are one of the league's best. And then they have that trek home via Minnesota. And Minnesota, again, is going to be a test. I mean, we saw them did well against them last week in a back-to-back. They'll be more rested this time around. But every game counts. It's kind of wild. It's really great, from both our storytelling aspect, but also for the players, because they do get more amped up for it. It is more exciting. You think about some of the games of recent seasons, 20 games of just dog hockey, and we're not going to be looking at that. And that, to me, is more than anything the most exciting thing about what's to come.
Yeah, my favorite quote from this season came from Joel Quenneville, and he said, there's a playoff race in the NHL. It starts in October and ends in April. And I think that is so true of the Canucks especially. And, obviously, they're moving on to a different test area now. They're going to be examined a lot more closely, a lot more stringently. The one thing I think really since mid-December and that loss in Montreal, I think they've identified a formula and an identity. And I think it's as simple as this. It's like, we've got a really good goalie. We've got a good power play. We have some depth scoring, and we like to play a fast game. They still allow a few too many scoring chances for my liking. It seems they have trouble defending, although in their last two games, I thought they'd really made strides. That game against Arizona, the last 10 minutes in the third period, that impressed me, because I thought they shut down the Coyotes when they absolutely had to. So they have that going forward. They know who they are. They know the way they have to play. So just go out and do it now. And I think that's important in the evolution of a team when you're searching for those kinds of things.
And, you know, they've had a couple of this hasn't been a bad year in terms of their road trips and the pressure that's been put on them. When we talk about them having a long break here, I look at February as being key because they do have that long trip to start, as Patrick talked about. Then they have, you know, the big, basically a 2-week homestand in the middle where the only team of significance that they're playing that's sort of relevant to their chase is Calgary. And then they go back out on the road for an Eastern swing. And then if you look at March, if they get through February in good shape, almost even tread water, you know, they've got so many home games. And you talk about Arizona, a couple of massive games against Arizona there. I mean, if this team can get through February, things would appear, as long as injuries don't factor into it, to set them up well in March.
Yeah, I think so, and I think that's kind of a part of the one of the developments that have really emerged this year. To me, the Canucks' performance has been such a function of their schedule. When they've been up against it tight as they were, you know, they hit the skids, you know, and then they had that homestand where they won 7 in a row. And then, they, you know, they go out on the road, and well, they win 2 out of 5. And then they come back home and they right the ship again. So, yeah, again, and I agree with your take. It isn't that so much that they gain ground in February. It's just that they hold their position or stay there, thereabouts, because then the schedule swings back into their favor in March.
And if you look in the big picture, and I've said this more than once, so people may be tired of me saying this, but they have 33 games left. And if you figure that, you know, they have 58 points, they need roughly 94. That means 36 more points, which means 18 wins. 18 wins in 33 games.
Is that analytics or math?
It's math. But I mean, that's all. I mean, and that's basically the pace they've been playing on all season, which to me is the biggest, strongest point in their favor in terms of how well Travis Green has figured this lineup.
Yeah, and in terms of their identity, the other thing is they've really established a presence on home ice here. And I think that goes.
Oh, and there's an atmosphere in the building,
yeah,
too.
No, yeah, 100%. And that, I think that becomes self-fulfilling when you have that confidence. When you have start to get a little swagger about your game on home ice, and it'd be remiss, and you know Patrick touched on it. You think of the way the last four seasons have gone, with the exception of that 10 days when we celebrated the Sedin's retirement.
Right.
It's just been depressing to be in that building, to have to sit and watch games, to sit there and watch them lose 2-1, 3-1, knowing they didn't really have a hope in hell of being competitive most nights. And now they flip the script there, and there is a reason to show up. And I'm really happy for hockey fans in Vancouver who've stuck with them. And I know that's cliched and horrid and all those things, but I never got the sense that people turned this team off completely. They were just waiting for a reason. Well, they've got a reason now.
So, all right. Well, part of the reason that the Canucks maybe did struggle the last part of the season is we've referenced analytics. Now we can check off the other millennial box of load management. But it well documented how this team's young key players struggled down the stretch the last couple of years. What do you see out of Besser, Pettersson, and certainly Quinn Hughes as we get in the last part of the season? Is there any risk that they're going to struggle with this?
I think it is a fair question for Hughes, and it's just because we've seen it 2 years in a row. We saw it happen with Besser. We saw it happen with Pettersson. The volume of games, the lack of sort of rest, the lack of ability to recover. You know, as the games pile up, as the season goes along, it's a little bit like the old line from The Wire where Prez is asked, you know, who wins a football game? And he says, well, nobody wins a football game. One team just loses more slowly. And it's a bit like that, right? You're in a race against the whole season. You're trying to keep yourself fit, but inevitably you're going to run out of steam. And you're just trying to make sure that it doesn't happen too soon. I think, you know, Besser, because he has experience, he knows about it. You know, he's going to keep it going. I think Pettersson is very much front of mind for him. He and I have talked a bit about it last year. And, you know, he doesn't like talking about his failures, but he does acknowledge the fact that it became a tough chore last year. This is more games over an extended period. I mean, they played long seasons, but they never played this many games over that amount of time. And so so Hughes, in the end, it's going to be a challenge for him because every other level he's ever played at, you play, you know, basically the number of games he's played now. And all of a sudden he has half a season left to go.
Yeah, so. And you know, further to that, I think the one single biggest difference between this lineup and last year's lineup is Quinn Hughes.
Yes, 100%.
You know, and you can make a case, well, you know, like Markstrom was pretty good last year. Yep. He's just maybe taking another step. Same with Pettersson, taking another step. I throw JT Miller into that mix as well. But, you know, he had a bit of a track record before he showed up. He's on track for a career best. Hughes is just this thing that dropped out of the sky into their lineup and has just given them something they have never really had in their 50 years. You know, an offensive driving defenseman. And the fact that this kid at 20 can run an NHL, not only run an NHL power play, run a productive NHL power play, a top five power play, is just mind-blowing to me. To me, he's gotten better here in about the last 2-3 weeks. But there's always a question with that rookie. How are they going to stand up to the rigor? How are they going to stand up to the demands and when things are amped up and the intensity and the physicality and all those things? I think he's handled it brilliantly so far, but it is so crucial to this Canucks team that he maintains that level of play. He's got a lot to play for.
Well, and isn't this where the acquisitions of Miller and Myers should really pay off?
Theoretically,
I think
Tanner Pearson, well, I think you throw him into that.
I think it's
mix.
Also, it is a sort of what else he lets you do. And the fact he is running the first unit power play means that you don't have to lean on Alex Edler as much. And that certainly was a question mark with Edler when they re-signed him. Would he actually be able to stay healthy? Would he be able to be a long-standing contributor to the lineup? And so far he has been. And partly it's because they don't have to lean on him as much. And that was that was an issue for all, you know, four previous editions of this team, is that they kept trying to strain. And the more you play at 100%, the more you're opening yourself up to risk. That's just reality. And, you know, all these guys I've talked to, that's sort of, you're chasing the game. You're pushing yourself beyond your limit. You keep doing it. You keep doing it. And so Edler now is in a great spot because of Quinn Hughes. They've got this really solid defensive defenseman who can still move the puck, by the way. Yeah. And it just lets them do other things. And you're right. Adding Myers he's not a perfect defenseman, but he's an upgrade on
what
they
had. He's a minute eater.
You know, and he's an upgrade on what they had before. It just lets them do other stuff that they haven't been able to do before. And absolutely, Tanner Pearson, great addition, great fit with Bo Horvat. That much is clear. And then JT Miller, heavy price to pay for him. But the guy has been a perfect fit as well.
Ed, we were talking earlier, and something that's, I don't want to say underreported, but maybe not getting the splash it would have in past seasons. Jake Virtanen's turned into a little bit of a player that they maybe would have been looking for at the trade deadline had he not developed this way.
Well, when I looked at this team back November, December, I thought they were still a player and a player and a half short. And, you know, my theory at the time was, well, those two players should be Jake Virtanen and Olli Juolevi,
right,
given where they were drafted. Well, if Virtanen actually is close to that player, and it seems to me he's, you know, showing signs that he is, that huge development for this team. It gives them another top six forward, and it was kind of that, you know, the bottom end of the top six, but that was the real weakness that I think most of us saw in this team, that once you got past, you know, the front end forwards, it was just too much of a drop-off. Now, all of a sudden, it's got a little different feel and shape to it, you know, and Green can play around. He's put Virtanen up with the first line, dropped Besser down to the third. Besser still gets his power play minutes. I'd like to see him continue to produce in that role, because they've been striving for this balance. And I think Green has referenced it several times, you know, trying to get three lines that can score consistently, and that makes them so hard to defend against. So we'll see where this goes. But again, that's another massive development for the organization. I just saw Virtanen making plays with the puck in those last two games he wasn't making before. I mean, he was all kind of like speed and wrist shot and no kind of finality, no kind of a bottom line to his game. But, you know, that pass he made to JT Miller on the 2-on-1 that, you know, kind of goal that ices it against San Jose. He also made a little move where, you know, he tucked the puck inside the stick and kind of drove wide on a defenseman and beat him to the outside, that really the real good forwards in the league make consistently. So again, it's another thing he's got a ton to play for, and I know he hasn't proved all the skeptics wrong, but I think he's changing some minds.
He's certainly done enough to earn himself a raise. I think that much is clear. Yeah. I mean, he's having a good year just when he needed to do it, and there's still things you want to see him do, but you're totally right. The playmaking aspect has been a nice thing to discover. He showed glimpses of it last year, but to really hit it home the way he is this year is a great thing for all people.
Well, I don't think I have the energy to talk about all these players who would earn raises in the salary cap and our next subject.
Yeah.
And in fact, this one exhausts me as well. But Patrick, since you're writing about him, I'm just going to say Louis Erickson. Go.
I mean, it was one of these ones where I was on an out-of-town radio show, and they asked me, well, what about Bo Horvat? And I kind of laughed. I said, well, part of the story is Louis Erickson. The laugh was kind of notable because even out of town, they know how badly things have gone for Louis here. And obviously being a scratch, I think it was 17 times through the first half until Josh Levo cracked his kneecap. You know, Louis has had a very nice impact on the lineup. He's found himself in a spot with a couple players who were already going well. I mean, I think Bo Horvat would tell you that things weren't going so well, and it's not because Louis joined their line, but things were not going well. They'd had struggles, you know, that sort of December wasn't a swoon. They'd sank in November, but they kind of were starting to sort stuff out in December. But even then, Horvat's line was having a hard time. And, you know, I think Bo himself will tell you that he kind of had to sit back and just think about, what do I need to do differently? How do I need to kind of get back to the player I need to be? And there's almost, you know, you can say Erickson's return is the story, but I think it's just Bo finding confidence. And so Louis has hitched himself to a shooting star. It's kind of what's going on, but he's been really useful. He's done well. I mean, of course, there was that somewhat hilarious slow-mo video of the empty net goal that he set Pearson up for last week that's received so many follow-on edits with various soundtracks being added to them, and the majesty of Louis flying after a loose puck, that sort of thing. He's found a role for him. He's found a role for himself that's working. And I think, you know, could you do better than Louis Erickson? Probably. But as things stand, it's a role that suits him well. He just needs to go to the net. He needs to win the pucks in the corner, and he's doing all that. And he still is a reliable defensive player. There's no doubt about that. So it fits what that line is asked to do, and good on him. It's funny. I still find it funny how all of a sudden everybody's cheering for Louis. Like, he was in the starting lineup, and I don't think that's ever happened before, but somehow he sort of flipped himself into the sympathetic story. People just wanted to do well.
One of the most surreal moments of this season was when the fans started chanting his name before the game.
Like, what's going on?
And it was unironic,
no.
too. And it was full-throated by the end of the game, too. That was
the fans.
Everyone
the fans
was a redemption
want
story.
Louis. Yeah, like, you know, you know, he's on the biggest salary on the team, but the fans want him to make it happen. It's kind of wild.
Well, I mean, you can see
this isn't Philadelphia, that's for sure.
But you can also see why the media gets tabbed as negative. I did see on sports radio a poll question last week: is Louis Erickson playing well or playing well for Louis Erickson?
Okay. Oh, wow.
So let's finish up by talking a little Canucks and 50. Again, thanks to our sponsors for this project, KeyWestFord.com, number one Mustang dealer in Western Canada, largest selection in BC. Gentlemen, the 90s was so funny, and this week Ben wrote a short story of 4,000 words on revisiting Capsule of the 1994 Stanley Cup Finals. Patrick, you were a kid during that time.
Yes.
You were a big Canucks fan. You were in Vancouver. I know Ed was covering the
Ed
league in Winnipeg.
Too.
No, he was covering the league in Winnipeg, though. You were here. What do you remember of the finals in particular?
It was epic. I mean, it was one of these ones where this was a team that obviously had been playing a lot better since the arrival of Pavel Bure, a team that was being taken seriously, and all of a sudden here they were. I mean, I still think about that famous Sports Illustrated cover where they asked, is this a better sport than basketball, which seems a wild thing to ask now, but that's how exciting.
It's just because the Rangers were involved.
Well, yeah, that's 100%
but it was an exciting, thrilling final. It was sort of everything you wanted hockey to be. And you were just enthralled by it all. I mean, I've told this story more than once, but I think game five is the crazy 6-3 win for the Canucks in New York.
Yeah.
And I was playing baseball. We were playing a game on the little Carisdale field behind Point Grey High School, and the job of whoever was on the bench on either team was to listen to the Walkman and keep everyone updated with what was happening. And it was like, Canucks are up. 3-0. Oh no, Rangers have scored. Oh, oh no, not again, guys, it's bad, it's again. And, you know, and all of a sudden it was just hilarious. And like, I think we finished the game, but everyone's just going bananas. And it was, that to me was such an encapsulation how everybody was so focused on that series and everything was exciting. And of course, game seven had the riot afterwards, but I have this distinct memory of, I watched it with some friends and I was on my way home. And my dad had picked me up and we were driving up and we come up to the top of the hill at King Ed and Dunbar, and there was a dad with his sons and they were had just like, you know, we still love you Canucks or something signs. They'd gone out just to cheer on the side of the road. And
King Ed and Dunbar. And
like what?
I believe the parade would have gone right past there.
They wouldn't. I don't know if that was going to be, so we had our own parade. But anyway, it was just, I mean, I know they didn't win and it's weird to celebrate a team that didn't make it in the end, but it was such a fun time. It was such a sort of fun two weeks and fun, you know, 2 months of hockey. It was a special time. I still have good memories of that team.
One of my issues there is, and this belies my age, it was my 10th high school reunion, which we had been planning for months.
Oh, wow.
Did not figure into the fact that the Canucks would be playing game six at home facing elimination on the Saturday night that we had the reunion.
Oh, God.
And literally four people showed up until the game was over. And then, and then it got merry. Thankfully, we'd had a pub night at the Unicorn the night before. But it really was. It was something that stopped the city in its tracks. Everyone wanted it. I mean, similar to 82, but different. Ed, we have talked about this before, but that team was such a characterization of a Pat Quinn team, was it not?
Yeah, it was. It was. And so the funny thing for me is the 92-93 team was far superior, in my opinion. You know, they were a 101-point team. They took care of a Winnipeg, pretty good Winnipeg Jets team, Timo Solani's rookie year in the first round. They get the LA Kings in the second round, and they should have beaten them, and they didn't. And so I believe that the 94 team finishes one game over 500.
42 wins, though.
In the regular season.
Yeah. They're one or two games over. It was hilarious. They lost every game.
But again, you know, Pat, as his want was, as GM, he makes this, you know, move, and we don't have the time to get into all the machinations of how they end up with Jeff Brown. But that in fact turns out to be the piece they're missing. And then
they get the story comeback
against Calgary, and now they're rolling. I covered that series for the Winnipeg paper, for the Winnipeg Sun, the final, and it was epic. For my money, probably the best final in NHL history. And I'm going back. I can't remember. I know there was one in 71 between the Blackhawks and Montreal that was up there. But like each game represented its own story, its own, like, you know, it's almost like, you know, a seven-part miniseries. And each one had its own storylines. You know, the first game where Kirk McLean has this unbelievable performance. And I just wonder if it's like a five-game series if they lose that one.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, but at the same token, they come home and lose a game where Pavel doesn't play.
Well, like, that's true. So Jay Wells was – I've been scratching my – yeah, that was
– Yeah, high stick on Jay Wells, gets suspended for a game.
And he gets kicked out of that game, right? Yeah, that's it. And then I can't remember.
Yeah,
we go back to game five in New York. And, well, this is it. And the Raiders went out and, you know, they had a bit of a gathering at one of New York's watering holes, and so we're all sitting there watching this crazy game five unfold, 3-0, 3-3, and then Dave Babich's finest moment is the Canucks. Now we're on our way back to Vancouver. In the meantime, this story breaks that Keenan is interviewing for a job in St. Louis while all this is going on. It was crazy, and that, you know, that game six, I think you can probably make the case, this is probably a larger conversation, but I still think maybe the best NHL game on Vancouver ice.
It's often claimed,
in NHL history. I don't know, that or the Stanchion game. I don't know which one. But that one was special, and then game seven. Actually, game seven, almost a bit of a denouement.
I had a good chat with Brett Hedekin on the weekend about the Pavel Bure trade in 99, but he wanted to kind of talk. He says, I think I should talk about 94 first, because of course he got involved in the trade and he had a couple great anecdotes. First of all, you know, that's his rookie season. He comes up against the Canucks partway through the season, had no idea who they were. They just, he basically said they ran over us like a bus. He's like, I had no idea. He's like, who are these guys? And he's like, tried to do sort of whatever, you know, research on whatever. He's like, I'm going to show these guys how it is. Brett also said, by the way, that that Blues team was not a terribly happy locker room. That was not a unified group. And he said, even from afar, he could sense that the Canucks were really united and that kind of thing. He's like, well, you know, I want to show these guys that like I'm good. And so he's like, the next time I'm going to be ready. And he said, basically, he gets out his first shift, pretty much. He runs over Gino. He says he just, I sort of stopped. I said, sorry, just to be clear, you said you knocked Gino Ojek. Or he goes, yeah. And he goes, Gino stood up and then basically started beating the tar out of me because he's just like, holy smokes. And then all of a sudden he's traded to this team. And he said it was just such an amazing group to join because they were so together, such a good group. But then on similar terms, you know, in terms of we talk about the community feeling, he said, you know, I can't remember which game it was. I think it was actually after they beat the Leafs. He says, you know, he and Nathan Lafayette were driving together. They were put up at a hotel downtown, and he and Lafayette were driving, and they just said people like saw them in the car and just started swarming and were just like, yeah, you know, like they weren't like angry. They were just excited, and they were just like, holy smokes, this team really means something. And it was just such a special time. It was a neat story to hear from a guy that was right in the middle of it.
We'll finish up, Ed. I wanted to ask you, because I know like moving on from 94, this is the thing with the decade. You mentioned Mike Keenan. When you looked at 82, and people assumed the Canucks were on to bigger and better things, and they didn't. They crashed and burned. And then rebuilding back up to 94, and you assume the Canucks were on to bigger and better things and signing McGillney, you look at how quickly it then went sour for Pat, and you look at how Keenan comes in, and you look at those characters who left this franchise. Now, Marcus Naslund was one of the ones who came in basically for that wreckage and then built them back up. You recently had a talk with Marcus for one of these episodes that you have coming up next week. Just, you know, it's crazy how quickly that Canucks era changed.
Yeah, only the Vancouver Canucks could add Alexander McGillney, Mark Messier to their lineup and get not only worse, but have the bottom fall out of the franchise. And it's crazy, the events. And I'm going back over it, and I was kind of like, I was in Montreal doing a freelance thing for a year. And then my first year here was 98-99. So I when I arrived, there was still just like the black cloud from the tire fire hanging over the city. So Keenan was the coach. They've just hired Brian Burke as the general manager, and we can all see where that's going. Yeah. But the year before, Keenan somehow gets he and Steve Tambellini are co-GMs, but Keenan's making all the player personnel decisions. He made 11 trades from the end of January to March, and these weren't like small trades. He's moving out Trevor Linden, he's moving out Marty Jelena, he's moving out Kirk McLean and Gino, like these people who really associated, you know, with this franchise. And Marcus arrives kind of, he arrived the year before, but he quickly emerged. It's quickly clear to him that he's not really in Keenan's plans, and Keenan goes to great lengths to reinforce that point. So he's really on the verge of asking for another trade out of Vancouver. And Berge says, don't worry, you're going to be here a lot longer than the head coach. And that kind of calms him down. But he's in the middle of all this while all the, you know, players are coming out and the captain's going in and Messier's in. And then they finish last in the division with this team with all these superstars. It's just a remarkable, remarkable period in Canucks history.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to keep going on, but...
Which is saying something, I think, established. Yeah.
But we've run out of time here. So thanks, Patrick. Thanks, Ed. Thanks, Darm. We will be back next week to bring you another pod. You can subscribe to us through Apple Podcasts and continue to watch our videos, read our stories every week. Thanks, folks.